Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. If you've heard the program before, you know what it's all about. This is where you hear from our greatest generation. The goal of this show, and it's to remind you that no matter where you live, no matter where your hometown is in this great country of ours, there's likely a hero around your corner, somebody who put his or her life on the line for the freedom that you're enjoying today, the freedom to sit around and listen to the radio on a Saturday afternoon. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories, and maybe along the way we'll be inspired too. And maybe that'll be the case today as I visit with 88-year-old Vern Thompson of Tulare, California. By the time this show's over, you're going to hear about Gunsmoke, you're going to hear about Disneyland, you're going to hear about Europe during World War II and a Bronze Star. But let's start, Vern, with something else that I like to ask each veteran about. This week we mark the 69th anniversary of the attacks on Pearl Harbor. You grew up in Louisville, Kentucky. So is that where you were on December 7th, 1941?
No. I didn't grow up in Louisville. But our family ultimately moved to California. And I had just graduated from Manuel Arch High School in Los Angeles. About 2 months out of high school, I was asked to play in a stage show band. Professional stage shows were still the thing, especially in the South, when they would travel to different theaters and put on the shows, vaudeville show. So I agreed to it, and we had a seven-piece band, and traveling on the road to different towns and in the South and different states was quite an example, a wonderful example in learning something about life.
So you're a teenager just out of high school, and you're traveling all over in a band, playing the trumpet, of course. So how did you hear about this event that happened in Honolulu, a place you probably never heard of Pearl Harbor before?
Well, no, you're right. We were playing at the theater in Richmond, Virginia. It was then, and probably still is, an enormous theater in terms of size. We were on stage as a band, and it was a Sunday afternoon, of course, and we were playing the appropriate music, and all of a sudden, I saw the manager come walking down the middle aisle, and right in the middle of our music, and he walked up on the stage and stopped the show. Well, none of us could imagine what was happening. He said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I must announce to you right now that Pearl Harbor in Hawaii has been bombed by the Japanese government." And that was about all he said. And he left the stage. We went on with the show. It made chills run up and down your spine when you thought, we as a nation were at war again. And it went on like that.
Wow, I've heard a lot of stories about that day, and that one has to be right up there with the most unique. So I imagine for you, the voice of that manager and the announcement that you just recounted for us is probably just as burned into your mind as FDR and his Day of Infamy speech.
Most definitely. In fact, we listened to it a number of times on the radio, right?
So here you are, still playing trumpet. You probably had a few more stops on that tour to go. When did you decide, hey, I'm going to sign up for the Army and make sure I do it on my terms, not Uncle Sam's terms?
Well, if I'm going to be honest, and I want to be.
Well, as a retired minister, you better be.
Okay. I thought, you know, if I got in an Army band, I might not have to go overseas. Ha, ha. Well, I did. I joined the Army, and I was in the band down at Camp on Riverside, California. In fact, there were three post bands there, and they would rotate the bands and sending them out to the firing range, which was about 30 miles northeast of Barstow, California. And we would go out there and get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, marching around playing Roll Out the Barrel. And to waking up the boys and getting to their training. But it was quite an experience that I will never forget.
So even if you're in the Army band, you still have to go through everything everybody else goes through. You have your boot camp, your basic training, and get whipped into shape. Was that everything you expected it to be, or was it a rude awakening with all the things they made you guys do?
I'd have to say that some of it was an awakening to just a barely high school graduate. That's what I was. And all our duties made up of marching about 5 o'clock in the morning out at Barstow when we would be given that assignment, as the other bands would do, of course. March around playing Roll Out the Barrel, and so the boys would get up and the training would begin day after day after day.
And it lasted that way for a while. You got to keep playing music and having fun, and I guess you made some pretty good friends with the guys who were playing with you.
Yes, certainly did. Many of the boys had come from a name band, and I remember, of course, Dave Brubeck was just then getting his start in not only the ability to play the kind of music he played from the piano, but also his ability to compose music. As you know, later on, and I don't have to belabor this, but later on, Dave Brubeck became a composer, even of some more, how would you say, what kind of music? High music, and at any rate. And then there was Ken Curtis, who was in our band at that period of time, and he later became very active on Gunsmoke as Festus. But more than that, even some of the other fellas had played in name bands. So it was quite an experience for me, something that I could never forget.
And there you were playing the trumpet amongst all those people, and you had no idea what they would go on to achieve in their lives, just like they had no idea what you would go on to do. But in terms of what you got out of it, the fulfillment that you derived from playing this music for guys that you knew were heading overseas, were putting their lives on the line. What did that mean to you, and did you ever get feedback from them as to what it meant to them?
We didn't talk too much about that phase of Army life, but some of us were sent down to Camp Bowie, Texas, and there for 3 months we were in training as line soldiers and in an armored division, which became, for us, the 13th Armored Division. And as you know, probably the troops in an armored division would amount to about 13 per half track. That is, the armored vehicle with front wheels and a track on the back, a tank track on the back, it would be called a half track. Today it's called a Hummer in Iraq, that would carry the troops up to the front line, and there we would get out and go to it.
So this was a big curveball to you. I mean, here you've told us you joined the Army band because you were hoping to avoid going overseas, and then they said, you know what, we're running out of people. We need some more. So break up the bands and put them in the infantry.
Right, exactly. Well, I'll never forget one time. It was when our division, the 13th Armored Division, was on the move in southern Germany, actually Austria, coming near Austria, as my memory will hold on this. But in an armored division, you have three groups, Combat Command A, Combat Command B, and Combat Command in Reserve, about 5,000 in each group. And we were on one of those moves, and we were in Combat Command B. We came to a high knoll that looked, when you got up at the top, you would look down at, and you could see a river down there about, and I'm guessing, of course, about 500 yards or so. But the problem was we had a stream up at the top of that knoll about 10 feet wide and deep enough that we couldn't get our tanks across our other heavy vehicles or any, some of the light vehicles. Well, to make a long story short, ultimately our squad was told to, they found a narrow area in which we could cross through the water, very narrow, however, but the 13 of us could cross, and we were told to go down that road to the river, the River Saar, S-A-A-R, coming, and in fact, the river went right near Munich, it did at that time, when I imagine it still does. But there we were. We were starting down that road on that Sunday afternoon, April 29th, 1945. And it was a bright, sunny afternoon, and I was the point man for our squad. And we were walking and spread out, walking down that road to go to the river to find out exactly if there was a bridge north or a bridge south still standing. That was an important piece of information that was desired. Well, we started walking, spread out, and everything was very quiet, and we got about halfway, and finally we got some small arms fire, and as many know, that when a bullet goes by you, it sounds like you're popping a paper sack. When you begin to hear pop, 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 you hit the ground, and you hit it fast, and we did. And we crawled down to the river, all of us, 30, safely, and lo and behold, down at the river bank, there was an adequate cover for the whole squad. A portion of the bridge still stood, and of course had been blown up across the river. But we made it down there, and we no sooner got in that area, but what the lieutenant said, Thompson, go up to the river bank, see if there is a bridge standing either anywhere. And I said, yes, sir, and I darted out. But none of us expected that that shack across the river had a machine gun nest. And I darted out like crazy, running, and all of a sudden we realized it was indeed a machine gun nest. And he zeroed in on me, but he missed, thank the Lord. I hit the ground so hard my helmet and helmet liner separated. And you can imagine I'm trying to get the two back together, put it on my head, do my body rolls, and get out of there. Well, the boys were all watching the show in a little group. And they told me later that some of the bullets were kicking up right around my head.
So you were all alone. The rest of them were standing by watching. This is you alone charging toward what you didn't even know was a machine gun nest?
Exactly. Right. So I did my body rolls, and I saw a higher point up at the bank. I squirmed up to that point, and I'm lying on my stomach, and I turned my head back to look at the boys. And about that time, one of the boys came out with a bazooka gun. Well, you know, the barrel is quite large. With a bazooka gun, and his first shot went right in the river, and the second shot destroyed the machine gun nest and everything with it. That was quite an experience that I can never forget.
Well, I don't blame you, and I might ask you a few more questions about it. Right now, we're going to take our first commercial break. We'll come back with more from Vern Thompson, 88 years old, of Tulare, California. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I'm sure you're enjoying it as much as I am today. Our conversation with Vern Thompson, 88 years old, lives in Tulare, California. He's a U.S. Army veteran of World War II. He's also a retired Baptist minister. Maybe you've heard him preach a sermon, or maybe you were in the hospital and he came and visited you. And you recognize the voice we're hearing today. I want to thank Jim Wilson for letting me know about Vern. So many of you send me your emails and call me with recommendations of veterans I could catch up to. And Jim said Vern was one of his hometown heroes. So we're talking to Vern today. And when we left off, Vern, you were telling us about April 29th, 1945 in Germany and the Saar River, the mission that you were asked to perform with your team, with your squad. And you end up all alone against a machine gun nest for a while till a bazooka comes and bails you out. I'm curious, though. Just not long before that, here you are, a trumpeter in an army band, thinking you're never going to have to see combat. How did you adjust to that mental difference from playing a few notes to dodging bullets?
Well, I must get a little patriotic here, but I mean it from my heart. I was happy to go overseas. I felt good about it because I was trying to do something for my country, and that's the way I feel.
You know, I've heard the same refrains from so many veterans, from there are no atheists in foxholes to anyone who tells you he wasn't afraid is a liar. Where do you fit in all that? Did fear run through your veins? How did you believe that you were going to make it each day in situations like the one you're describing?
Yeah, I remember one night, I had dug a foxhole. I could sit up on the edge of it. But that night, it was foggy. It was thick fog. Here I am sitting on the edge of my foxhole. I was on a outward perimeter as a watchdog, so to speak. But I'll never forget that night. Nothing happened. It was weary because of the fog, I guess. It was thick. And then way late in the morning, it began to rain a little bit. It was a mess. A teetotal mess. And thank the Lord the enemy wasn't nearby. I may not have been able to spot him right away either. But that was about it. It was just the idea that I was alone sitting on the edge of my foxhole. Nothing happened, but it was just the inner fear that is so a characteristic, I think, of a soldier in a combat zone.
Did you find strength or encouragement from fellow soldiers? Were there thoughts of home that kind of picked you up? Was your faith a factor at that point?
Yeah, let me say it this way. I remember that we had crossed the Rhine River, and we had come into a city, and at this moment I can't think of the name of it, but as was customary, we would go into one of the German homes and tell the people that they must move down the street to our neighbors. While we use their home, we only use it for sleeping, and for we had 10-1 rations, and it demanded a stove of some kind, and in the morning. So I remember, and we were tired, and as I got in bed, I literally, just like you would see in a movie, I put my head down on that pillow and all of a sudden, there comes the booming voice. All right, up and at 'em, everybody. Get up. Get ready. And we left. And what had happened, they divided four companies of us in a pincer movement in the hillside area, the other side of Cologne, out in that area. Beautiful country. But it was the black of night. And here we are. Our group, going, all of us were going single file in a pincer movement. And I remember we were walking down the paved two-lane road. And then all of a sudden, our group left the road and walked up over a hill. And on our left, there were a lot of trees on a knoll. And everything was deadly quiet. Anything that was said was whispered. And I remember I didn't realize it at the moment that we were doing a pincer movement of the four companies. And here we came up over a knoll, a high knoll that was balder than a man's head. And all of a sudden, they begin to whisper back, lay down, prepare to fight, lay down, prepare to fight. Oh, I'm scared to death. We were on a bald hill, and to our left, it go down. And in the gully and up, it's all trees. Well, we could hear some of the limbs of them cracking, people walking, in other words, through them. And we of course, some of us envisioned the enemy, and we were sitting ducks, and it was a full moon that night. I'll never forget that scene. I had confiscated some German binoculars from a prisoner, and I had them around my neck, and I will not go into detail, but I heard that the Germans did something awful if they took you prisoner and you had some of the German equipment. Terrible things. Well, I laid down, everything is dead quiet. And I reached up and grabbed the straps of those binoculars and took them off, just in case we were taken prisoner. But it happened to be another one of our companies making that noise, we found out later. And that was the extent of fear that came because of the unknown.
Sure.
Here, yeah.
So did you keep the binoculars then?
I left them laying on the ground. I didn't do it on purpose. I was so angry with myself that I did that. Well, you know, I remember going into a house of one German family. Never will I forget this scene. We went in and we told the lady there that she had to go down the street and stay with some friends. We were just using her house for sleeping and to use the kitchen stove in the morning with our 10-in-1 rations. And she had two little boys, and she asked if she might be allowed to go down into the cellar, which was accomplished by this opening door in the kitchen floor. And being a bunch of old softies, because of the two little boys, we let her do that. We were going against rules right then. And you could imagine the danger of that kind of thing. Well, she went down there with her two boys. And in the morning, we got up. We were working the kitchen stove. And she came up out of the cellar. And in her hand was cupped, as she said, she couldn't speak English, and one of the boys could speak some German. And she showed us four little coffee beans in her hand. That's all she had for breakfast, she said. She said this to the one boy that could understand some German. Well, of course, we shared our breakfast, our 10-in-1 breakfast with the enemy, quote unquote. And I'll never forget, as we left that house, she went around patting us on the shoulder. And she says, gut Americans. Things like that you never forget.
Yeah, and it really puts it in perspective for us, I think, too. And probably when you think of it, you think of what the German people were liberated from in terms of the tyranny. I imagine you think of that family and the chance they had after the war.
Absolutely. And, of course, not all the German people would agree with Hitler in his approach to military battle. They wouldn't do that. And I can't believe, in fact, I'm positive in my own heart that could not be, that some of the German civilians, and maybe many of them, were of Christian faith. Well, you can't hate. It just doesn't work if we hate people. Now, I don't want to get into the area of battle and in the fit of the fighting in battle and all of that, but what I just said is truth, and that must be taken as understood by each of us.
No question about it. I want to take you back to that April 29th incident with the machine gun nest, because I don't know if we quite finished that story. We were certainly feeling in your shoes as you went one-on-one with much more firepower than you had. The bazooka finally took him out. How did it wrap up from there, and when did you realize the importance, the strategic importance of what you had done? Was it when they gave you the Bronze Star for it, or maybe before that, that you figured it out?
I think the machine gun nest across the river firing specifically at me was the epitome right then of a lesson for me and so on. There are some fellows, of course, who went through far, far more horrible things than I'll ever face, I trust. But we know that war is like that. It's terrible. Very terrible. Yeah. What happened in that riverbank there, the Czar River, there are times in battle in which you feel so helpless. We who are Christians, of course, we're praying for God's great help in our lives. Only naturally would that be a reality in my book. And there are times when God does not allow certain things to happen, and for his cause, for his reality in our lives, to make sure that we understand that he is working in our lives.
Something tells me you may not have had time to pray in that instance when the bullets are flying left and right around you.
Yeah, boy, that's the truth. You know it, yeah. Yeah.
So would you say that was the closest call you experienced? There wasn't anything else quite that hair-raising for you personally?
I think personally, yes, as far as the machine gun nest, yeah. I'm just flabbergasted. I didn't get it that day. Why, I was a sitting duck. But it happened so quickly, and in battle like that, when things happen so quickly, you can't understand why this didn't happen there, that should have happened, and so on. That's only a part of life. It's a part of battle, part of being in the Army.
No question about it. Well, it's time for another brief commercial. When we come back, we'll hear about the rest of the war. There wasn't much left of the war in Europe from April 29th, just a couple weeks left of the war in Europe, but why Vern thought he might be headed to the Pacific, too, and how it all played out for him since. Vern Thompson of Tulare, California, our guest today. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Time to continue with Vern Thompson of Tulare, California. You've heard him describe how he joined the Army to play the trumpet and did that for quite a while with some names that would later go on to become familiar to some of us. If you're a fan of Gunsmoke, I bet you didn't know that Festus played in the same band as our guest today, Vern Thompson. Dave Brubeck, a great composer, was also in that band, but the band was broken up, and Vern was sent overseas with the 13th Armored Division, the Black Cats as they were known. He earned a Bronze Star for the events he described on April 29th of 1945. And at that point, Vern, it's only a couple weeks till VE Day. Were you guys starting to get a sense that that the war in Europe was coming to a close, or were you in the dark to all of that?
No, I remember the day that President Roosevelt died. Our division was coming through one of the German cities at that point, and I'll never forget this scene. It was so realistic in the reactions of a prisoner, and that is our division was moving down a street in a city in Germany, and we came to some of our officers knew that this was an area where armaments were sold. I mean, not sold. What's what I'm talking about? An area in which armaments were made, constructed, and we stopped our whole line. And the sergeant said, "Thompson, you and Huffhofer, go through that armament building and see what you find." Of course, it was totally empty. We went out the back, and lo and behold, I saw something that was rather weird in that in the back of that armored building was a trench, an old War I trench. You just didn't see hardly any of that in World War II. But there it was. And I said to Hofer, "You go down at that end, I'll go at the other end, and we'll walk, come in together, make sure we had our bayonets fixed if we needed them." And as we started to come together, Hofer yelled at me. He said, "Vern, come over here." And he had his rifle pointed down in the trench. And sure enough, when I got there, here was a German, probably a civilian soldier, German. It was in the corner, an elderly man, what I would call now, about 45 years of age. And he was huddled up in the bottom of this trench, and he was looking up at us, and he just knew we were going to shoot our guns and kill him. But, of course, we didn't do that. And it had happened in the war. We know that, but not this time. And we gave him a nudge. We moved our rifles, come out of the trench, and he did. We took him prisoner. And that's all to the story. But the dramatic moment, as you looked at the face of this German soldier, when we said, "Come on out, we're taking you prisoner," the relief that came over his face, it was tremendous.
Well, and I think what we hear there is one of the truths of war, that you have that power, yes, to take a life, but you also have the power to spare a life. And it sounds like doing the latter comes off as a much more fulfilling and long-lasting feeling for you.
Sure, yeah. No question about it.
Now, you mentioned Roosevelt dying. Of course, on the other side of the world leader spectrum at that point was Adolf Hitler, who famously observed many things from his eagle's nest that we've all seen pictures of. Now, you have a picture, and I'm going to post some of these pictures here on KMJNow.com, Vern then and Vern now. And one of these pictures is you sitting up there where Hitler's headquarters were. How did you come to his eagle's nest and pose for that picture?
Well, our division was not too far from that area down below. And most of us didn't realize this was Hitler's, one of his secret hideouts, his place of meeting with his officers and planning battles and this and that. And in the Alps, high in the Alps, it wasn't too far from Salzburg. I know that. And one morning we had a truckload of GIs that were going up to the top to see Hitler's hideout. I think it was called Berchtesgaden, but now I'm not sure about that terminology. But it was Hitler's hideout. It was a place where he met with his high officials in relation to field battles and so on. Yeah.
And did that kind of underscore a sense of victory for you guys, that you could stand on that ground in that kind of mood and atmosphere?
Absolutely, to know that the soldiers had been using this place to better have strategy, a strategy for battle. That would be it, yeah.
Now, one thing that I've picked up on throughout our conversation here is that so many of the human moments in the war stand out for you when you pick up on emotion either in yourself or in someone else. And there's another photograph that you have of some boxcars. And here you have a train depot, and you guys are going one way, and on a train on the other tracks heading the other way are some Russian refugees liberated at the end of the war. Now, that's just a still photo. Give us the moving picture. What transpired there that made that instance stick out in your mind so much?
Yes, that's another one of those I'll never forget. Our train load of our division pulled into Strasbourg and stopped going in one direction, and the other train on the other track was loaded with, we were told, with Russian refugees. Thank you. Yeah, Russian refugees, and stopped. And it hadn't been still very long, but what? Some of the Russians got out of the boxcars and began to do the typical Russian dances on the platform. Oh, boy, that was something to behold. We had some of the people coming up to our boxcars wanting to buy black market materials. That some of that would be a cigarette and cigars and sweets and so on. It was really something. But I'll never forget this scene. Both of our trains pulled out simultaneously. They going in one direction and we going in the other, the opposite direction, as we headed for Le Havre to get on a troop ship and come back to America. As the trains were gradually pulling out together, lo and behold, the trainload of Russians began to singing. You could hear them singing in the distance. Da 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 da. Da 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 da, that tune that's so familiar with some of us. And it was quite an experience.
And I guess that kind of made you realize that this was about a lot more than America, and that your effort had done a lot for a lot of people all over the world.
Excellent put, yeah. Beautifully put, better said.
Well, and you said you're heading home for America at that point, but there was a time where you thought your division would be headed to Japan. And I've talked to a lot of veterans who were in the Pacific, and they were expecting to make that invasion of mainland Japan. The estimates were for more than 1 million casualties early in that offensive if the bombs hadn't been dropped. What did that do to you when you heard, wow, I might be going to another war?
Exactly. We were told by the general that we would, as I've already said once, that we would be the first armored division to land on the shores of Japan. Now, that meant that they had to do some things very quickly. That's always puzzled me, because we again got on the troop ship at Le Havre, France, and it took about 4 days to get back to America, full speed ahead kind of thing. And we went to an army camp up here near Lompoc. Today, it's called something else, I can't think of the name of it, but up here by near Lompoc, and there they would reactivate us, and then they would fly us over to the battle zone, and there we would be with over 1 million Americans lined up to invade Japan.
And fortunately for you, there were a couple bombs dropped that saved you that duty.
That was exactly it. There were probably more lives saved than not. Yeah, oh yeah. It brought an end to the war quickly, finally. Yes. To the battleship Missouri, many went.
Absolutely, where the surrender was signed. Well, there are still some questions I have for Vern, and we have a few minutes left. We'll take our final commercial break here. When we come back, we'll talk about what he's been up to since the war and how he ended up here in the San Joaquin Valley in Tulare, California. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. The time has gone by really fast today, as it usually does. But Vern Thompson, I think you know by now, is a pretty good storyteller. His memories are crisp, and we're going to talk about some more recent memories. He made it home from the war. If he hadn't survived World War II and his unexpected infantry duty, he never would have met his wife, never would have fathered his children, never would have had any grandchildren. And now a couple of his grandchildren have another grandpa named President Jimmy Carter. I won't get into the whole long story about that, but because of your mutual grandchildren with President Carter, Vern, you've gotten to know him a little bit. And he too has a story about his service in the military. I'm sure you guys have some common patriotism there.
I think so. Yeah, I've been with President Carter and his wife a number of times on a number of occasions, and gotten to appreciate him and to know him and his wife to some degree. So I'm thankful for that relationship.
Sure thing. And I know you were thankful to meet your bride and celebrate more than 50 years of marriage and have a family. And at some point, you decided to get into the ministry. Now, what motivated that to become a minister? Did it have anything to do with your experience in the war?
I don't think had any hardly anything to do with my experiences in the war, because it comes somewhat later. In other words, I didn't enter the ministry till I was 30 years of age, and it was down in Anaheim. I worked for Kwikset Lux, and which had just started as a company, but I began to feel that God wanted me in a ministry. And I knew what was ahead, and my wife did, and she was more than willing to support me in relation to my schooling, and which she did until she died of cancer. And we lived in Anaheim, and I had come on staff there. You want me to go right ahead with Disneyland?
Absolutely. You know, I just spent the last day with my kids at Disneyland. It's one of the greatest places ever. And you were there in the early days of Disneyland and had a special duty because of your role as a pastor.
Right. That's right. Disneyland had not yet come alive. They were working feverishly to get it ready in that period of time. Well, finally, the day came. And what had happened was that the senior pastor of the First Baptist Church of Anaheim was Bob Kevorkian. I was his associate. And he happened to be, at that time, the chairperson of the Ministerial Association in Anaheim. Well, Disney Associates came to the Ministerial Association and told us how they wanted 500 Sunday school children to open Disneyland, and that we would divide them in as we could into equal lots. Actually, it would be probably more like 9, 10, and 11-year-olds, basically, that would be involved in this. Well, we 2 weeks before Disneyland opened, the Disney organization sent out buses for us. We went around to the different churches there in Anaheim, picking up children like you can't believe. And we took those 500 Sunday school kids downtown to Anaheim to a theater. And there on the screen, the Disney people projected Disneyland as it is now, as it was then. A Frontierland, Fantasyland, and on it went, and told us they would like to have us divide the kids into equal groups as much as possible, and then each group would be behind a ribbon in the corresponding area of fun and all of that. So we did that, and on opening day, if you ever watch an anniversary again of the opening of Disneyland, and it does happen every now and then, be sure you watch it, because you're going to see these children rushing in, running in to Frontier, the Fantasyland, and so on, all the lands. And it was a great day. It really was. Oh, we lost a couple of kids, but we found them. But and it was fun. It was really great. And what a privilege it was to be in charge of those kids.
Did you have any idea on the very first day of Disneyland, as you're frantically trying to chase down kids who are disappearing, did you have any idea that it would become the cultural establishment that it is today?
Not a bit. Not, no, not at all. Oh, I bet it has. That's a good way to put it, yeah.
Well, you've had a very colorful life, Vern, and I know you're not done. You're still playing tennis every once in a while at age 88. I think you should start playing that trumpet again, too.
Yep.
In closing, when you look back on all of it, making it through the war, despite some of the situations you found yourself in, your career in ministry, what are you most thankful for? And why do you think you are one of the ones who got to come home and live the life that you've had?
I'm thankful that people put up with some of my idiosyncrasies, whatever that means, have been so kind. It's been such a blessing as a minister, certainly to serve people and try to be of help in various ways as life came along. I thank God for it.
When someone realizes that you're a World War II veteran, when they see your 13th Armored Division patch on the wall or your Bronze Star on your desk, and they say, World War II, what was that all about? Why were you guys over there? How do you answer that? When you look back, what do you think is the most significant thing for us to remember about what you and the guys like you did?
Well, I still love our country, and what I mean by that is that I love what our country stands for, the good things, the right things. And certainly the willingness to be a part of an endeavor to keep our country going. When we, even today in our time, we look at certain groups that are not too healthy in terms of what our country stands for, the freedoms that we have, and so on. I thank God for His power that I believe has been interjected in the lives of many of the great leaders of our country.
Well, I'm not going to argue with you there. Vern, thank you very much for serving our country, and thanks for telling us some of your stories.
You're welcome. God bless you all.
Amen to that. That is Vern Thompson of Tulare, California. He's been our guest today. If you want to see some pictures of this good-looking young man then and now, go to our website, kmjnow.com, or check out Hometown Heroes on Facebook. Thanks for listening today here on News Talk 580 KMJ.